Good morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. As the President of the Commonwealth Games Federation, Mike Fennell, prepares for high-level meetings with the Indian government today, the organisation's CEO is distancing himself from responsibility for the escalating crisis. Mike Hooper has blamed the Indian bureaucracy for the disastrous preparations, saying they were warned on numerous occasions about the extent of the problems, and he says the Federation has been let down by Indian authorities. Mike Hooper is speaking here in New Delhi with AM's Jane Cowan.
How serious is this situation now?
Well, it's obviously the whole situation has been very serious, and it came to a head on the 20th when Mr. Fennell issued a press release and indeed wrote to the Cabinet Secretary to elevate it to governmental level.
This has been seriously escalated though, hasn't it? I mean, teams are threatening to pull out.
Well, when you say teams being threatening to pull out, I mean, I haven't had a direct threat like that. Everybody has basically said, look, we're here to work together, we want to resolve this, but we cannot bring our athletes into the environment as it was between at the 16th of September 17 when we saw it and went through and saw the other towers.
Do you take any responsibility for the mess that this has become? Because you have been on the ground here for several years overseeing these very preparations.
Sure, not at all. And the reason I say not at all is because, quite simply, the CGF contracts the Government of India, the Delhi Government, the Organising Committee, we didn't have the resources to deliver a Games. We have five staff total. We have pushed and cajoled and worked hard to get people to get things done here. It's the finishing that's got to be done. And that's where we, unfortunately, have been let down. And to a certain degree, you've got to, whilst it doesn't change things, the Organising Committee itself has inherited this as a consequence of getting access to the venue so late. If they'd been delivered when they should have been by the government agencies, then obviously more could have been done sooner. It's not a nice position to be in. It's been very stressful for everybody concerned, but everyone now is focused on getting it right.
Should you have sounded the alarm bell earlier?
The alarm bell has been sounded on an ongoing basis, with due respect, both in relation to
without
all the
effect,
venues.
Without effect, though?
I beg your pardon?
Without effect.
Well, you can lead a horse to water, you can't make a drink, I think is the saying. I mean, we've been trying, we've been pushing. You know, we want this to work for India, we want it to work for the athletes of the Commonwealth, and so the issue right now is let's work together to make it work, and then we can have the post-mortems later.
At the soft opening, though, of the Games Village last week, you didn't have a bad word to say.
We were talking about the opening of the international zone. We were talking specifically about the dining hall.
Why not flag
and
the problem, now, though? Did you deliberately avoid the accommodation?
I didn't deliberately avoid anything. We quite simply have been working, we were working internally, as we prefer to do, with the Organising Committee and others. By the close of business on the 19th, when these matters were supposed to be resolved, they weren't. Our level of frustration, the CGA's level of frustration blew over. Mr. Fennell got directly involved, and he was being kept informed all the way along, and issued the statement he did, wrote to the Cabinet Secretary and brought it to the highest level possible, the Government of India.
Is there any chance that these Games could actually be called off?
We are focusing on delivering the Games and commencing these Games on the 3rd of October. That's what we're all focused on doing. That's what I believe will happen.
CEO of the Commonwealth Games Federation speaking to AM's Jane Cowan. Mike Hooper, the CEO of the Games Federation. The opposition leader, Tony Abbott, has not only backed out of a deal with Labor and the independents to pair the Speaker's vote, but the coalition is vowing to continue playing hardball, even refusing to pair government ministers travelling overseas during parliamentary sittings. It's now likely the government will be forced to nominate a Labor Speaker, which will reduce its majority from two to just one vote in the House of Representatives. It means even a single absence from the government's ranks could lead to defeat on the chamber floor. Labor does have another option, but it's a long shot. It will try and lure a renegade coalition MP to accept the Speaker's job. Alexandra Kirk reports from Canberra.
Tony Abbott's walked away from a deal to pair the Speaker's vote, earning him the ire of the government. Julia Gillard's majority could be cut to just one vote if she follows tradition and puts up a Labor Speaker when the new Parliament starts.
They went to the Governor-General. They said that they were able and capable of being able to form government. Well, part of forming government is being able to establish a Speaker. They got till next Tuesday to do it.
After a one-term retirement, Liberal MP Warren Entsch is back and the new Chief Opposition Whip. One of his jobs is to organise pairs.
I guess each one will be taken on its merit.
For decades, the major parties have had an informal arrangement to preserve the overall numbers by sacrificing a vote if an MP from the other side is absent with good reason. But now it's a case of no more Mr. Nice Guy.
It'll depend on circumstance. I mean, issues such as national interest, etc., etc., will be taken into consideration. But to just expect it's going to happen so that somebody can have an overseas jaunt is, you know, highly unlikely.
But clearly some ministers need to go overseas in order to do their job. For example, like the foreign minister, the defence minister, the immigration minister, they're not overseas jaunts.
Well, it depends on whether some would argue differently in some of the cases. And of course, each one needs to be assessed on its merit. And there are a lot of times when we're not sitting.
If Labor MPs aren't paired, government legislation is at risk of being blocked.
If people think that it was a great deal of fun going to Germany for one night, I think common sense would tell people that that wasn't the case.
The manager of government business, Anthony Albanese, is calling for some maturity.
Is someone having a child in the national interest? I guess there's an argument that it is. There's an argument also that someone I know received a pair to see their child go to school on their first day of school. What we need is just a common sense approach to this.
Labor's also playing hardball, hunting for a Liberal rat to be Speaker, as one government MP puts it. That way the Coalition loses a vote and Labor's buffer is boosted. The opposition's working hard to ensure that no one breaks ranks. Warren Entsch doubts the government will succeed.
I'm not aware of anybody in the Liberal Party that is offering to do it. I'd be very surprised if that was the case. Certainly, if anybody was going to do it, I would expect that they would be seeking approval from the leader.
The Chief Opposition Whip, Liberal MP Warren Entsch, the reporter Alexandra Kirk. As one of the key independents who threw his lot in with Labor to put Julia Gillard into power, Tony Windsor knew that he would anger a good number of people who voted for him in his seat of New England in northern New South Wales. Last night he fronted up to the criticism when he attended a packed public meeting at a theatre in Tamworth. Tony Windsor says the two main parties are much the same except for a few differences, but he says he and other independents chose to support Labor rather than have another election. Brendan Trembath reports from Tamworth.
Things are looking up in Tamworth, Australia's country music capital. The surrounding fields are green, and the local MP, Tony Windsor, has more clout in federal politics.
This is quite possibly the best parliament that the agricultural sector will see.
400 people from across the region turned up to see Tony Windsor speak at Tamworth's Capital Theatre. The event was organised by a local newspaper. He fielded 20 questions from voters, including this man, who demanded to know how could Tony Windsor hitch his wagon to the Labor Party.
How can you have faith in a Gillard government to not only understand the needs of regional Australia, let alone deliver, when every member of the cabinet is metropolitan-based, and most of whom have backgrounds in trade unions?
Mr. Windsor defended himself and his recent decision to help Labor stay in power.
I haven't hitched my wagon to anybody. I'm as independent as I've ever been. What we've allowed to do in a parliament where no one has a majority, so a government can't be formed without the assistance of independents. And rightly or wrongly, we've chosen the Labor Party as opposed to another election.
Tony Windsor says Australia's two main parties are now very similar.
They're the same. Few minor differences in social issues. They actually have to invent the differences now so they can have the argument.
They do disagree on Labor's plan to spend billions of dollars to bring high-speed internet to rural and remote areas. Tony Windsor argues it's worth it, but others here disagree.
What were your reasons in supporting the Labor Party's proposal to spend $43 billion on a national broadband network when no cost-benefit analysis had been done to establish its economic usefulness?
Most things that are done by government don't have a benefit-cost analysis. The Adelaide to Darwin railway line. If someone had done a benefit-cost analysis on that, they would have shelved it. The inland rail that we're all very keen on.
Tony Windsor now has more influence to push for such projects, but he says he won't just favour his electorate.
What I attempted to do in terms of this regional package wasn't pork barrel the seat. What we've done in terms of regional Australia is pork barrel regional Australia in a sense.
What's this, a country politician admitting to pork barrelling? He chose his words more carefully after the event.
Well, in a sense, pork barreling is not the right word. Addressing some of the inequity.
Tony Windsor hopes to do just that in the new session of Parliament.
It's going to be a real test of people in the building as to how seriously they take it, because I think the Australian public, particularly as the months unfold, they're going to want to see active participation in this Parliament, not a traditional executive versus opposition game being played. So there's some real risks.
The Independent MP Tony Windsor ending that report by Brendan Trembath. And you're listening to AM Around Australia on ABC Radio National, where it's 20 and a half minutes past seven. Internationally, we're being heard on Radio Australia. And a reminder, the audio and transcripts of our stories today and other stories from the past can all be found on our website at abc.net.au/AM. China's chosen the Australian Navy as its partner for what's been called the most intense war games with a foreign power in its history. The live firing exercise finished just a few hours ago in the Yellow Sea off northeast China. The ABC's Tom Eagledon was granted exclusive access aboard a Chinese frigate taking part in the exercises, from where he filed this report.
China's never allowed Western media onto one of its Navy ships during live target practice before, but times are changing. We're on the Yellow Sea off northern China aboard the Chinese Navy frigate Luoyang as 80mm guns open up on a target almost 3 kilometres away. Also firing is the Australian frigate Warramunga, which is also taking part in the joint exercises. Smoke fills the Yellow Sea air after each firing. Chinese Lieutenant Commander Tony Zhao is happy with the result.
We had a very good cooperation today. And because today we use the weapons to strike the target, I think that shows our relationship.
After criticism it's been too secretive about its military build-up, China's on a charm offensive. And it's chosen Australia as a partner to show the world its intentions are peaceful. It's never before conducted joint target practice with a foreign navy.
So that shows you the extent of how far we're moving forward.
Commander Bruce Legg is the Australian frigate's commanding officer.
So what are they telling you about why they're so keen to have this sort of special relationship, if you like, with the Australian Navy?
Well, they haven't actually told me, but it is quite clear that they are very keen to work with the Royal Australian Navy.
One reason could be military tension between China and the United States. China's unhappy about US arms sales to Taiwan and is refusing American invitations to take part in joint naval exercises, just like this one.
If the United States stops selling the weapons to the Taiwan and stopping spying us, on the air or on the surface, I think that will do good to the communication and to the cooperation between our two countries.
Commander Legg says though Australia's a close ally of the United States, tensions between Washington and Beijing aren't any of his business.
Well, I don't even think it's necessary to have the US here, because it allows Australia to just concentrate on working together. We're working very closely with China. We certainly don't need America to do that, and you can see just how forward we're moving with this.
Last year, Canberra named China as Australia's biggest strategic threat, prompting an angry response from the Chinese Foreign Ministry. As an Australian Seahawk helicopter performs a daring winch manoeuvre, hovering above the flight deck of the Chinese frigate, that dispute, it seems, is ancient history. This is Tom Eagledon reporting for AM aboard the Chinese Navy frigate Luoyang on the Yellow Sea.
For a long time, everyone thought or hoped that Cedric the Tasmanian Devil had the genes to combat the horrific and deadly cancerous facial tumours decimating devils in Tasmania. For 4 years, AM followed Cedric's progress, but last month he died, finally succumbing to the disease. But the scientists who are using Cedric to develop a vaccine against the contagious cancer say that thanks to Cedric, their research is very much alive. Felicity Ogilvy reports from Hobart.
Researchers from the University of Tasmania have spent almost 4 years trying to develop a vaccine to protect devils from the facial tumour disease. A devil called Cedric became famous when he responded to a trial immunisation with what appeared to be natural resistance to the cancer. But then 2 years ago, Cedric caught the cancer and he died from it last month. Cedric was always a vocal devil. But that changed in his final days.
The devil keepers noticed that his voice had changed a little bit, and that's one of the reasons. And he had some coughing sometimes, and that's the reason why we took him to have an X-ray of the lungs, and we suspected that there was something. But he was still eating and behaving normally, so that's one of the signs that he probably wasn't in much pain.
That's Dr. Alex Kreis. He had the sad job of helping to euthanize Cedric. The Tasmanian government took the body and buried Cedric deeply for biosecurity reasons.
Cedric was only one animal, and he gave a lot of information to us. But we still have half a dozen devils to keep trying developing a vaccine.
The head of the vaccine project, Professor Greg Woods, says the research has become complicated.
We really need to look more at the tumour cell. What we're predicting initially was that the tumour was very similar to the devil's own tissues, and that's still strictly true. But now we have to maybe modify that tumour cell or try to do something to make that tumour cell look different to the devil's own immune system so that it will respond. In the past, we just tried to boost immunity. Now we have to try to trick the immune system.
If they can create a vaccine, it will be used to protect the devils, who are living in an insurance population on the mainland. It's hoped those devils can be used to repopulate Tasmania if the wild population becomes extinct.
Felicity Ogilvie reporting. When it comes to the AFL, it's often said you either love or hate the Collingwood Magpies, the largest team in the league with over 58,000 members and just as many supporters. Tomorrow, the Magpie Army will be out in force as Collingwood plays St Kilda in the grand final. The Saints haven't won a premiership since 1966. When they did, they beat Collingwood by just 1 point. For the Magpies, who will go into the game as favourites, it's been a shorter 20-year drought between flags. Alison Caldwell reports.
Not far from the MCG, the Collingwood Magpies cheer squad meets at the back of a Catholic church in Richmond. They're putting the final touches to their black and white striped banner, which the team will run through ahead of tomorrow's match. The priest won't bless the banner, he's a Swan supporter. But the cheer squad isn't deterred.
What do you think of the banner?
Looks brilliant. It's going to look very good on telly, and when the crowd sees it, everybody's going to be gobsmacked when they see this.
Collingwood finished the season at the top of the ladder and goes into tomorrow's final the clear favourite, having beaten St Kilda convincingly twice this year. Cheer squad member Chris Glitzos is quietly confident.
I think this year will be our year, and I'm not going to jinx it either.
People say that if you're not a member or a fan of Collingwood or a supporter in Victoria, you usually hate Collingwood. Why do you think that is?
Jealousy. That's all I can run it down to, jealousy, because we are a successful club.
It will be insane. There will be Collingwood supporters everywhere you look. You would not believe how many Collingwood supporters there. There will be over 300,000 Collingwood supporters in the city alone.
Go Saints!
Last year's runner-up, St Kilda, gets a second chance at glory in as many years tomorrow.
Murray, there's the side!
Forty-four years ago, the Saints beat Collingwood by just 1 point to win their only flag in a century.
After striving for 70 years.
I'm more confident than I was last year just because we've got the experience, we've got the hunger. Collingwood had the hunger to get into a grand final, but we've got a hunger to win it.
St Kilda's players have tried to keep this week as normal as possible, even referring to tomorrow's final as round 26. General Manager Greg Hutchison says he doesn't know how players will make use of last year's loss to Geelong once the first bounce happens tomorrow afternoon.
Look, it hasn't been spoken about. Certainly there was a lot of hurt and pain from the game last year. Whether it has any help for them on Saturday, we'll know at 5:30 on Saturday night.
St Kilda's General Manager Greg Hutchison ending Alison Caldwell's report. To the financial markets now, and in New York, the Dow Jones has closed at 10,662 points. That is down 77. The Nasdaq closed down 7 points. In London, the FTSE finished the day down 5 points. The dollar has slipped to be just below 95 US cents. It's fetching 80 Japanese yen and 71.25 euro cents. Tapas crude in Singapore at $81 a barrel. That is down about $1.30. I'm Tony Eastley. That's AM for today.